On this edition for Saturday, August 8th, the president weighs in on COVID-19 economic relief, international aid and recovery efforts in Beirut. And Russia keeps a close eye on an election in Belarus. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. With talks between the White House and Democrats stalled over a new coronavirus aid package, President Trump took matters into his own hands today, issuing executive orders. Late this afternoon at his golf resort in New Jersey, the president announced that payroll taxes and student loans would be deferred through the end of the year, an eviction moratorium would be extended, and he would divert unspent money from an earlier relief bill and from FEMA to extend federal unemployment insurance payments.
It's $400 per week, and we're doing that without the Democrats. We should have been able to do it very easily with them, but they want all of these additional things that have nothing to do with helping people.
States will have to contribute 25% of the cost, and the extension will be voluntary for those states. Enhanced federal unemployment benefits expired a week ago. The $600 payments have been a major point of contention between the White House and Democratic leaders working on a deal. Mr. Trump defended providing unemployed people less money than they were receiving in the previous relief legislation.
This gives them a great incentive to go back to work. So this was much more than was originally agreed. The $600 was a number that was there. And as you know, there was difficulty with the 600 number because it really was a disincentive.
The money has not been a disincentive, according to findings by both economists at Yale as well as the Chicago Federal Reserve Board. In a call with reporters today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the executive orders don't make much of a difference and urged the administration to come back to the negotiation table. Senior administration officials said they are expecting legal challenges as Congress controls federal spending, which could lead to delays in implementation. Mr. Trump also mentioned the Paycheck Protection Program, which gives potentially forgivable loans to small businesses. Today is the deadline for applying for that program. As of Thursday, more than $520 billion have been approved to more than 5 million businesses. The program has about $130 billion left in appropriated funds. A federal moratorium on evictions expired 2 weeks ago. Democratic leaders have said that Mr. Trump could extend the moratorium through executive action, but have also said it's of limited use without rental assistance. We will have more on the evictions moratorium after the news summary. Coronavirus continues to spread throughout the world. There are now more than 19 million confirmed cases in 188 countries, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins. More than 700,000 people have lost their lives. In Brazil, the death toll is expected to hit 100,000 today, and that country is still reporting more than 50,000 new confirmed cases each day. Cities in that country have continued to ease lockdowns, even though the pandemic has not yet reached its peak. The United States remains the global leader with nearly 5 million confirmed cases and more than 161,000 deaths, more than one-fifth of the total reported coronavirus deaths around the world. The U.S. reported nearly 61,000 new confirmed coronavirus infections yesterday, according to data compiled by the New York Times. On average, that's actually an 18% decline compared to the daily total 2 weeks ago. A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that Hispanic and Black children have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic at disproportionate rates. In the study of more than 500 COVID-19-associated hospitalizations published yesterday, researchers found Black and Hispanic children were hospitalized at dramatically higher rates than white children. The disparity among minority children follows the racial disparity in coronavirus hospitalizations among adults. Black and Hispanic adults have been hospitalized at a rate more than four times higher than whites. In Beirut, protests over the Lebanese government's response to this week's deadly explosion turned violent today. Lebanese riot police fired tear gas at protesters in Beirut's city center. Some protesters set fires and threw objects at police. There's been widespread anger at government officials over corruption and incompetence at failing to prevent the massive blast on Tuesday, which killed at least 158 people, injured 6,000, and left hundreds of thousands homeless. More than 2,000 tons of explosive ammonium nitrate had been stored at the port for years. Since the blast, at least 19 people have been detained, including the port's chief. Even before the blast, Lebanon was in the midst of its worst economic crisis in decades. Dozens of people are still missing, and at the site of the explosion, rescue workers, some of them from other countries, continue the search for survivors. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Layla Molana Allen has more.
Let him come back. Dear God, just let him come back. At the entrance to the Beirut port, the epicenter of Tuesday's explosion, desperate families sit for hours, praying their loved ones will be found. Zainab is waiting for news of her husband who worked here. He hasn't been seen since the blast. Inside, a scene of utter devastation. The acrid stench of burning metal, plastic and chemicals hangs heavy in the air, black ash coating every surface. Packing crates spill out charred, misshapen lumps amid the rising dust, barely recognizable as the freshly imported goods once stacked in these warehouses. A washing machine here, what might have been a glass jug there.
Just a few days ago, this was a thriving port, Beirut's lifeline to the rest of the world. And now, piles of rubble, twisted smoking metal is all that remains.
And underneath that rubble, human beings. These disfigured, crumbling ruins were once Lebanon's national grain reserve. 15,000 tons of wheat and 10,000 of corn were destroyed, now forming an unstable mountain of waste through which rescuers must wade. Dozens of countries have sent rescue teams to help in the effort. These French rescue workers have been digging non-stop for 35 hours to try and reach seven people they believe are buried underneath at least 30 meters of concrete and earth. The conditions are extreme. They're working in full protective gear in 90-degree heat, in air thick with toxic fumes and dust. But even more perilous are the structures on the point of collapse that surround them.
The main danger is from both above and from below. From above, the structure behind could collapse with any vibrations. And from below, when you're looking for the foundations, if you hit the wrong spot, you could get collateral damage.
The risk is so great that the Turkish Red Crescent has set up a field hospital directly behind the search and rescue site. It's not only for retrieved victims, but for the rescue workers in case something goes wrong.
So it's set up just like a real emergency room.
Exactly. Yes, this is a real emergency. Or a ventilator.
So you have a ventilator here, you have a monitor,
yes.
Anything that people
yes,
might
monitor,
need for serious
mechanical
injuries.
Ventilator.
And the risk isn't just at the port area. The explosion destroyed residential neighbourhoods for miles around. Here in Jemaisi, one of the worst hit, the search is ongoing for both survivors and whatever can be retrieved from people's homes and businesses. But many buildings are now dangerously unstable, risking further collapse and injury. Back at the port, the team are using sniffer dogs to try and find dozens of other missing workers who could be buried along the seashore. Meanwhile, families like Zainab's can only wait, wonder, and hope.
Layla Molana Allen joined us from Beirut earlier today for more on the situation in Lebanon. How is Beirut recovering now?
Beirut
is trying to recover. What's happening at the moment is that people are trying to figure out how they're going to live over the next few weeks and then look beyond that. So part of that, obviously, is the reconstruction of homes. So many homes damaged here in the immediate vicinity, completely ravaged, and up to 9 kilometers away, a lot of damage happening. And what we're seeing is this incredible effort of groups of young people, armies really, arming themselves with brooms and spades and striding out into the town, walking down the streets, clearing up, turning up at people's houses and walking in and saying, we want to clean, what can we do? And if there's no one there, they clean up anyway. Of course, one of the biggest issues at the moment is still the ongoing injuries in hospitals. Every hospital bed is full. Still 60 people, more than 60 people missing, and probably many more than that. That's how many have been reported. So lots of families desperately still looking, of course. The whole community is just trying to get through the next weeks before they can think about the months and the year after that.
Leila, most of the world has not been paying attention to what's been happening in Lebanon over the past several months. It's also in a state of economic crisis. So who pays for this cleanup? How does this work get done?
So it's estimated at the moment that the damage is $15 billion, which is quite incredible for a country that already was in such dire straits. Right now, the majority of this cleanup on the streets is being done by the people. The only place where the authorities are doing things is down at the port, because the army operates the port. But it's a lot of logistical care, and what we've seen is a lot of international aid coming in. So that started a couple of days ago, and they're just teams from all across the world doing medical care, doing search and rescue.
So you've got pre-existing economic crisis, a pandemic, and now a catastrophe. All of these frustrations are starting to boil over into the streets.
They are. The anger has been palpable the last few days. The posters that have been going around saying, now we do cleanup, but on Saturday, that stops and we clean up the government. We sweep them out. And for the last few hours, they have all been in downtown Beirut. And immediately, the moment the protest started, tear gas was unleashed. Then rubber bullets started. Dozens injured, and the rage that is on the street. I have not seen this level throughout the entire protest movement here. They've now managed to breach part of the parliament wall, which is where the security forces have been trying to keep them away from. There's also obviously a fear of COVID-19, and hospitals have been sending out instructions on how to keep yourself safe in the demonstrations, almost an implicit endorsement of the fact that everybody is out on the streets and angry, so angry at this government.
Leila Milana Allen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Harry.
For more on the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. National and state eviction moratoriums have been a big part of the economic relief for COVID-19. But even if restrictions are temporarily halted, they can have long-term impacts. Are there other solutions to America's housing crisis, which has been made worse by the pandemic? I spoke with Matthew Desmond, a professor at Princeton University, who helped build the first nationwide database on evictions at the university's Eviction Lab.
So in a normal month in America, 800,000 people, about the population of Seattle, are threatened with eviction, have an eviction filed against them. That's a normal American month. That's an American month when unemployment's below 5%. Now, when we have unemployment at levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression, there are millions, by some accounts, tens of millions of families who could face eviction over the year.
And because of the pandemic, there has been some stimulus money, $600 a week, a supplemental income to unemployment insurance that has also expired. How crucial were those $600 to families that were at risk?
Incredibly important. And we already saw warning signs on the horizon that even with that extra $600 boost, it wasn't enough to shield families from homelessness. In May, Houston allocated $15 million extra dollars in rent relief. It was gone in 2 days. In June, cities like Cleveland and Milwaukee saw evictions spike 30 to 40% above normal levels when moratoriums expired.
What is unclear to me is, what does a landlord gain by kicking a family out? Because depending on the rental market, it's not like that family is suddenly going to give the landlord the money that they owe if they don't have any money at all. And unless you have another renter lined up, you're not really getting that money that you want if you're the landlord, right?
Right. And so in this case in particular, eviction solves nobody's problem. It certainly deepens the poverty and the vulnerability of the families that will be cast out of their homes. And it also doesn't solve the landlord's financial problems. You know, eviction right now, though, is kind of the only tool we've given to landlords, right? We haven't seen a serious investment in housing from the federal government. And so when you're a landlord and you're at a pinch, you kind of reach for that pink slip. Some landlords do it grudgingly, and after months of negotiation, some landlords are really quick to do it. But it's not going to solve their problem in this situation. It's only going to spread more disease and more poverty.
You have built a database in the Eviction Lab at Princeton, but what kind of transparency exists? How do we know how many people on a state or city basis are getting evicted, if they're getting evicted repeatedly, if there are the same landlords or some landlords are doing it more than others? How do we figure that out?
We know a lot less than I think we should. You know, I published a book on eviction in 2016, and it was based in Milwaukee. And I went around the country talking about the book, and people in Houston and Baton Rouge and LA were saying, what's my eviction rate? How many people get evicted in America? We had no way to answer that question. The federal government does not collect data on eviction. It doesn't even know how many evictions it executes through public housing, housing it owns. And so we did build the first ever national database of eviction in this country. We found that, you know, about every minute, 7 evictions are filed all around the United States. And this is affecting communities big and small, communities with high housing costs and pretty low housing costs. It's a nationwide problem. But this should be a problem that's at the top of the national agenda and worthy of our attention. We need really hard data on this that's not just collected by some ragtag group at Princeton, you know, that are going after the data.
So what agencies should be responsible for this? What can the federal government do to try to lead states in the right direction?
I'd love to see the Department of Housing and Urban Development take this over and really kind of track, you know, which cities have the highest and lowest eviction rates, which laws work, which laws don't, bring some accountability to who owns our cities, you know, which property owners are evicting a lot of people in Baltimore, and which property owners are not, you know, and I think that, and what can we learn from them? I think this is something that the federal government needs to pay attention to and is beginning to. So in December, there was a bill called the Eviction Crisis Act, a bipartisan bill that was passed in the Senate, or that was introduced in the Senate, excuse me, that would do just this, that would build a national eviction database at HUD. And I hope it kind of gets momentum and passes.
Are you seeing the spikes now in the number of people who are being evicted?
We're beginning to see them. We're beginning to see warning signs on the horizon. I think the moratoriums worked very well. The CARES Act helped a lot. And I think there were many property owners that were negotiating with their tenants across the country. But as those moratoriums disappear, as the federal aid stops, I think we're going to see a lot of evictions right around the corner.
So how do we get out of this?
We need serious federal investment. That's the best way out of this. You know, we need a national moratorium on evictions. We need to say, look, In this pandemic, the home is medicine. The home is safety, and we have to protect that. Americans deserve that level of protection. Property owners need to pay their bills too. And so we don't just need moratoriums, we also need rent relief. We need a serious investment from the federal government with the recognition that, like, everyone needs a stable, affordable place to live in normal times, and especially during this pandemic, that's true. So I think that the stimulus debate that we're having now is incredibly important. It's literally a life or death issue for American renting families.
Matthew Desmond of the Eviction Lab from Princeton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, voters in Belarus will cast their ballots in a surprisingly competitive presidential election. Authoritarian leader Alexander Lukashenko is facing a challenge from a political novice after ruling for more than a quarter century. As special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky reports, it's an election where the country's relationship with its neighbor to the east, Russia, looms large.
These are pictures of the Belarusian security service arresting men it claims are mercenaries from Russia last week. According to Belarus state television, Moscow sent them to stir up chaos ahead of tomorrow's presidential elections.
The hotel administration became suspicious of the visitors because of their unusual behavior for Russian tourists. They did not drink alcohol or visit entertainment venues. They kept apart and tried not to draw attention to themselves.
State TV displays the men's personal belongings, parading them for the whole country to see on their television sets. It's an unusual bout of hostility for two countries, which until recently considered themselves the closest of allies. But in Belarus, these are unusual times.
I am tired of being silent. I am tired of being afraid. And you? Are you tired of being patient? Are you tired of being silent?
For weeks now, the public has been rallying around this woman. Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya is running as the sole opposition candidate in a surprisingly contested election for a country that's been run by the same man for over a quarter century. She threw her name in the hat after her husband, a video blogger, was jailed and barred from running. Two other opposition leaders were also struck from the ballot. One fled the country, the other was imprisoned. Tsikhanouskaya has gathered massive rallies like this one, attended by thousands of supporters in towns and cities throughout the nation, something that's never happened in this tightly run dictatorship before.
Today, Belarus's leader faces a wave of discontent like he's never seen before. Earlier this year, Russia hiked energy prices in a pressure campaign to push Belarus into an ever closer union. Then, the coronavirus pandemic hit, which he dismissed as something you could treat with a shot of vodka. Now, thousands of Belarusians, usually earning money abroad, are stuck at home penniless. It's the perfect storm.
But Belarus's embattled president isn't ready to give up the reins of power just yet.
We won't let you take our country.
Central to his plan to stay in power are the arrests of the alleged Russian mercenaries, who his security services accuse of arriving in Belarus to help Tikhanovskaya's jailed husband sow discord.
These people, they have given testimony. They were sent to Belarus specifically. Their orders were to wait. We have our own country. The country has laws. No one knows our laws better than our dear Russian brothers and their leadership.
It's a scenario that may be ringing bells for those who remember the crisis in Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula in 2014. Uniformed men without national insignia, who later turned out to be Russian soldiers, appeared in key locations to wrest control of the territory away from Ukraine after a revolution created a power vacuum there.
The Kremlin understands that it is a real opportunity for them to advance Russian national interests now in Belarus, especially because Lukashenko is in a very vulnerable and weak position.
Arseniy Savitsky is director of the Center for Strategic and Foreign Policy Studies in Minsk, an independent think tank. He told NewsHour Weekend he feared Russia could use the political instability in his country to overthrow the regime in favor of a more pliable leader, or worse.
It seems that we are preparing for a major battle with the Russians, not only in the political sphere, but also in military one. I'm a military officer in reserve, so 2 weeks ago I received a mobilization call from the recruitment office, and I was told that I need to be prepared for snap mobilization in case something goes wrong.
Russia hasn't taken the allegations of election meddling sitting down. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova called the arrests of the alleged military contractors nothing more than a play, adding ominously that Minsk knows Russia won't let any harm befall its citizens. With no international observers invited to monitor Sunday's polls, Katsarina Shmatsina of the Belarusian Institute for Strategic Studies fears Lukashenko is planning to falsify the vote in his own favor and use the alleged Russian mercenary plot to besmirch the opposition in the eyes of the public as being sponsored by foreigners, but also to send a message to Washington and the EU.
Either support Lukashenko, who is a politician who provides the sovereignty of Belarus, or otherwise, if there's someone new coming in, he or she might not able to contain the Russian aggression.
Meanwhile, Belarusian police have taken a harder stance on rank-and-file opposition supporters, resting close to 1,000 over the last few weeks, according to Shmatsina, even though political rallies are sanctioned ahead of elections. Whatever happens in Sunday's vote, be it an unlikely Tikhanovskaya victory or a crackdown on the political opposition, Belarus is in for a tense few weeks as its larger neighbor to the east waits and watches.
We will have more on the emergency COVID-19 financial aid plans online tonight and on air tomorrow. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.